Good morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock Horizon Investments Economic Update Call. Hancock Horizon Investments provides this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions, please email them to david_lundgren@hancockhorizon.com, and he'll take them at the end of the call. On today's call, we have Chief Investment Officer John Fortwood and Investment Directors David Lundgren and Jeffrey Tangus. And with that, I'll pass the call on to David Lundgren, who will be the moderator.
Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to this month's edition of our Economic and Market Update call. And probably as expected, we're going to start with Brexit. For those who aren't aware, on Thursday, June 23rd, voters in the United Kingdom elected to exit the Eurozone. And John, if you could, maybe for our listeners, just give them some basic facts about what that means before we get into the implications and some of the possible scenarios on how this plays out.
Well, at the base case, the implication is that they would want, to leave the Eurozone entirely. At least the initial hysteria based on this vote suggested that the United Kingdom was going to back away from all of their Eurozone agreements, go it alone, end up with some sort of strange independent arrangement without any contact at all. Well, we know that's not going to be the case, but it does call into question the general viability of the Eurozone as it currently exists and points up the fragility that has existed there for a number of years with their demographic problems, their debt problems, and so forth and so on, and the exit of Britain in a very quick manner would, of course, call the viability of the Eurozone into question. Nobody really expected, that to happen completely, but it certainly created some questions, and it also created the question of whether or not other nations within the Eurozone, might want to follow Britain's lead. So it caused a great deal of confusion, and I guess the confusion is going to be with us for some time.
John, if we could, maybe, based on what I've read, there really are three possible scenarios. Actually, there's probably hundreds of possible scenarios, but I think they really fall into three separate camps. One of them is that it doesn't happen at all. And based on what I've read, there's possibilities, depending on who the new prime minister might be, that there could be a vote to make this not happen. Talk about that scenario first, and then we'll walk through the other two broader categories.
Okay.
And the likelihood of each.
Yeah, the doesn't happen at all probably is not very likely, at least not in the near term. As you mentioned, there's going to be a new prime minister in the UK. There's going to be some governmental shakeups. And I read one article that suggested, given all the rules and regulations and timelines that would need to be followed, it could be 3 or 4 years before anybody got around to the point of suggesting that another vote might be called for, given, let's say, some polls that suggested the vote might go the other way to remain in the EU. So it's not likely, really, that that's going to happen in the near term. And probably, given some of the reports I've seen recently from the politicians involved on the Leave side, that's probably not likely to happen and would probably cause some serious, dislocation within the United Kingdom. So I think that's probably a low probability event, at least for the next several years.
Okay. Another scenario, it's been referred to as Brexit Light. Others have referred to it as the Norway solution, where Britain has a lot of the benefits of membership without being a member, such as access to the EU single market would still be in place. Free trade would still exist. Talk a little bit about that possibility and what that might look like. And I guess that would be, from an implication standpoint, the most favorable for markets and the economy.
Yeah, that would be the more favorable outlook. The politicians that were in favor of the leave vote have suggested in the last few days that, this isn't really a problem. We want to make some changes here and there. We don't want to leave the European Union. We don't want to, leave the free trade zone. We want to trade just as we always have. We just want to make some changes that provide for more sovereignty in terms of decisions we might want to make as a country. And that sounds very reasonable. The initial response to that by some of the EU members was not particularly positive, but we also see reports that examine in some detail the impact on countries like Germany and France from a leaving by the United Kingdom and some destruction of the trade that currently exists, and it's not very pretty. So from a practical standpoint, it looks like Germany and France would probably be willing to adjust policies to keep the UK in the European Union and just move on. Of course, if they did that, they probably have to adjust some policies for everyone else too, but then everybody thinks that policy adjustments are probably needed for the whole European Union to keep it viable. So, and that might be a good thing. So I think that's probably the likely outcome of this. And of course, as you said, it's one of the many outcomes that could happen that, maybe we like to think about it as being likely because it seems to be the more reasonable. But in any case, at this point, given everybody's interest, that would seem to be, the best deal. By the way, Norway and several other smaller countries are connected to the EU through something called the European Economic Union or something like that. And again, as you say, they're part of the trade zone. They have some trade restrictions on some of their products and so forth. But it's worked pretty well for them over the time. It's worked very well for Norway over a long period of time. So, let's hope that wiser heads prevail and that we do get some sort of policy decisions that work this out to everybody's general satisfaction without a lot of disruption going forward.
And John, before we move on to the third scenario, the leaders of the leave camp, really it was more about policy regarding immigration and not necessarily economic or trade-related policies. Is that a fair statement? And is that also a reason to believe maybe there's some sort of middle ground that's reached?
That's probably the case. More than immigration, it was also about sovereignty in the sense that Britain does not have complete control of their court system, and some of the things they do have to be, or they would like to do, have to be approved by the European Union courts in Brussels. For example, there was a, and still is, a radical imam at a particular mosque who was preaching terrorism. That's basically what the British claimed, and they decided they wanted to get rid of this guy because they considered him dangerous. They wanted to deport him. They could not do it because they couldn't get the approval of the European Union. So that's a particular case that I think rankled a lot of people in Britain. Also, Britain has had record immigration as a member of the EU and in line with their policies, but it's brought in a whole lot of low-skill people from Europe, and that's been a sore point. And at the same time, as I understand it, the agreement prevents Britain from admitting more high-skilled immigrants from somewhere else. So they're sort of in a bind from the immigration standpoint. They have to take who the EU says they have to take, and then they can't perhaps try to offset that by, you know, picking and choosing people they might like to have in the first place. So it's and certainly that's a a big piece of it, and that's also rankled a lot of other countries in the European Union because of the migrant situation coming out of the Middle East. They've all had to divide up the masses of people that are coming in. Some countries can handle it better than others, and even the ones who can handle it better than others from the standpoint of the numbers find out that the populations are not particularly happy about it, and that's been particularly the case in Germany. So, you know, a lot of things are happening that are probably going to, have to be changed to keep the Eurozone intact. But yeah, that's certainly been the immigration issue has certainly been a big part of it. Should I go on to the hard line by the EU, what the odds are for that?
Where it's scenario number three, a much tougher stance by the EU versus Britain. Obviously, that would have, I'm guessing, major economic impact. Talk a little bit about that scenario and the likelihood of it.
Yeah, it would. It would be a complete breakdown in the free trade arrangements throughout the Eurozone. It would be, in a sense, I guess, a replay of, and this might be a bit harsh, the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of the 1930s that helped prolong the Depression in the U.S. and around the world. Highly unlikely that would happen, but certainly it would be a very bad outcome. Initially, there were a lot of hardline comments coming out of the European Union, our way on the, or the highway kind of thing. That seems to have faded significantly, and I noticed over the weekend that Nigel Farage, who was the leader of the UKIP party, that was certainly behind the leave vote, and he's been arguing for that for a number of years. He resigned over the weekend his position and said, you know, he wanted to get his life back and was wanted to take a rest for a while. But there's probably something political behind that. He's been sort of a thorn in the European Union side for a long time. If you want to see some pretty entertaining video, go to YouTube, Google Nigel, N-I-G-E-L, Farage, F-A-R-R-A-G-E, and watch his speeches in front of the European, committee, and you'll see what I mean. Anyway, the fact that he is stepping away may be a plan to reach a more agreeable conclusion, I guess, among all parties involved with, you know, without his being there and simply aggravating the hell out of everybody, if I can use that that term. So so that's probably also a positive in that we're likely to move into a period, maybe a long period, but at least a period of policy changes and policy workouts that will, produce a better long-term result.
So just to sort of sum it up, not to minimize the impact of this at all, it will have some long-term implications, but the most likely scenario is going to take time, 3 to 4 years, and while there will be some disruptions, this isn't going to be cataclysmic going forward. And John, is that a fair statement?
I think that's probably true. Everybody knows what happened in the 1930s. Everybody knows about the Smoot-Hawley tariff. Everybody knows about what restrictions on free trade and globalization, particularly if done abruptly, would do to the world economy. And I think, something will be done to alleviate that as much as possible. The unfortunate thing about what's happening now is that it didn't just begin. It started a long time ago, certainly over the last 5 or 6 years, and certainly since about 2011, world trade volumes have declined about 25 or 30%. Part of that is a decline in growth rates. Part of it is a masked attempt to for individual areas, the Eurozone, the U.S., China, to manipulate their currencies and, in effect, gain competitive trade advantages, while at the same time saying we're really not manipulating our currencies. We're just trying to do what we need to do internally to improve economic growth. Now, at the same time, they all knew exactly what was happening, that, in effect, it was sort of a minor currency war, I guess you might say, going on, and that's still the case. China, for example, was accused of, and they probably were, dumping steel products in the U.S., so we raised duties on Chinese steel because it appeared to be completely destroying the U.S. steel industry. And so there are things like that that are going on that suggest we're going from, what was, a wide-open trading situation to something that is less so. But, again, you can probably, eventually, work out some trade deals that keep everybody happy. But in any case, from an economic standpoint, there's a squeeze on world trade going on, and it's probably just part of the general, slowness of economic growth that we've seen since the Great Recession. But, if that sort of thing can be kept to a manageable level and policy worked out over time, then, absolute and complete disaster, and it probably can be avoided, since everybody knows what the ultimate outcome would be. But as you say, it's going to be difficult for a while, and I would imagine that it will have some further impact on global growth. At least it's not going to improve things. Somebody made some guesses the other day about what it might do to Europe, and they said, well, maybe it might slow European growth by 0.5%, which would keep them, at about 1%, and it's bound to have some sort of an impact on the U.S. But
why don't we go ahead and talk about the impact on the U.S. economy, both, immediate and then longer term, and then also, briefly kind of talk about what the second quarter is shaping up to be.
Yeah, longer term, obviously, to the extent that global trade is reduced or impeded in some manner, it's going to have, some impact on the economy from the standpoint of restricting growth. In the near term, the Brexit vote to leave has strengthened the dollar. A stronger dollar has some impact on corporate earnings, and of course, that could have some ripple effect through the economy, to the extent that, corporate profitability is reduced. But the dollar really hasn't strengthened out of its, trading range for the last year or two anyway. So that's probably not a significant impact at the moment. From a market standpoint, of course, a financial impact might be a little bit greater than economic impact currently because nobody really knows exactly what's going to happen to the extent that uncertainty increases. Markets become somewhat more volatile. For example, this morning, because of the, still threat that, the UK may exit the Eurozone, the pound sterling is weakening. There have been some, and with that, the threat of perhaps a recession in the UK caused some outflows in some real estate funds in Europe, rather in the UK. And this morning, a couple of real estate funds halted trading because the outflow was too great. That sort of thing, of course, indicates that, liquidity is not all that great in the financial markets and, could lead, to some, contagion around the world and more volatility and so forth and so on. I don't think it is yet this morning. I think that's just something that's local to the UK. But that's the kind of thing that I suppose we have to get used to as all of these things are worked out. it's just going to be an unsettled time for a while.
Okay. Thank you, John.
Jeff Tangus, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Well, the Fed has, I guess, been walking on eggshells, it seems like, for 18 months regarding their policy, and I can't imagine that this is going to make them very eager to raise rates. But I'll let you comment on that.
Well, in June, the past month, the Fed met for the fourth time, and for the fourth time elected not to do anything. This is really, that was the fourth meeting that they had telegraphed prior to the meeting that the market needed to get ready. They were going to be doing something really soon. And once again, they decided not to. That was actually before the Brexit, so we can't blame Brexit on that. They had, excuse me, they had, even in that meeting, their own forecast, what they call the dot plot, started coming down. In other words, even the Fed governors started to acknowledge that global growth was weak and that they were just really way too ambitious on rate increases. But I think they wanted to keep the market on notice that they could do it, so they sort of kept up the language. But then Brexit happened, and the world changed pretty dramatically after their June 15th meeting. So, you know, if you go back and you think at the start of this year, the market in general expected two rate increases this year, one in April and one in December. We, of course, didn't think that. We thought maybe one, maybe December, but we didn't think that two rate increases was justified. Fast forward now, post-Brexit, no rate increase this year is anticipated by the market. No rate increase is even anticipated next year, 2017. At this point, the probability, the market implied probability of a Fed rate increase really doesn't hit until 2018, and there's a lot. Brexit is the number one reason for that sea change, but the manifestation of Brexit is a dramatic decline in interest rates in Europe across the board. And so, it's very difficult for the Fed to go in an opposite direction when the rest of the world is dramatically lowering interest rates. All the central banks in Europe have announced stimulus programs to support their stock markets and support their economies so that they don't see a recession in the wake of the Brexit news. Apparently, central banks no longer want to tolerate even a mild recession of any sort, so they are willing to do just about anything, and anything includes creating new things that have never even been done before to keep rates low. The most fascinating part of all this is watching negative rates basically wash across Europe and really around the world. On two-year government securities now, France is a negative 60 basis points, a little over a half a percentage point. Spain is a negative 16, and Portugal is barely positive. And one of the most ironic examples of this whole Brexit scenario, Portugal, which is really a basket case, barely can pay its bills, actually has a lower two-year interest rate on its government security than we do in the U.S. I'd love for John Portwood to explain to us why that makes any sense whatsoever, because I don't think it does. It's really crazy. So,
it doesn't make any sense. Only to the extent that. You can blame it on the European Union and European Central Bank, I guess, supporting them, but it's a weird situation.
Well, and the most weird is Switzerland, which for the privilege of loaning your money to the government, they will charge you 1.2% per year for 2 years to allow you to loan them the money. So this is clearly the bizarro world. And the Fed is going to be on hold for some time. There's just no way around it. Our economy here in the U.S., as John talks about it, continues to plod along. But again, the comment that Fed central banks around the world really don't want to see a recession of any sort, tells us that rates have to stay low, and that that our Federal Reserve will probably even discontinue talking a big game. I think they're going to tone down the rhetoric somewhat, and they've already started that to some degree. Yellen has spoken since Brexit, and a few other governors, and they've all taken the approach that, yes, we're just going to have to sit down and see how this whole thing develops. So a lot of backstory there on the Federal Reserve, Dave, but the bottom line is they're finally coming around to the rest of the market's conclusion that rates aren't going up anytime soon.
Let's talk a little bit briefly about the long end of the curve. We started the month of June, the 10-year Treasury was at 185, and as we were speaking this morning, I believe the 10-year hit a new all-time low of 137. So just an amazing decline in rates, and when we saw the stock market recover, yields continued to go down, which, you know, was sort of unusual. So talk a little bit about longer-term maturities and kind of an outlook there.
Well, you know, everybody talks about the 10-year now, and you're right. The 10-year, on an intraday basis, we did dip down. On a closing end-of-business business day basis, we still have the 2012 low intact, but essentially we're there. So it's just a matter of time. What we're seeing here is two things. I mean, everybody talks about flight to quality. Certainly with the prospects elevated of some kind of a slowdown in Europe and around the world, capital flows to the United States because we have, again, your choices are Portugal or the United States. You're probably going to choose the United States because the yields are better and the quality is a lot better as well. What's just as fascinating is and something not many people talk about anymore is the old U.S. government 30-year security, which has sort of been abandoned as a standard, but it's still out there. And what we know there is that we have hit a new low, all-time low of 2.17%. John, our resident historian, tells me that that record goes back to 1949 in terms of a low yield record. So historic by any measure. So you've got not just a flight to quality, but I would argue also it's a flight to yield. So if you want any kind of yield, not only do you have to take maybe some more credit risk, but you also have to take maturity risk too. You've got to go out on the spectrum, out on the maturity curve, and invest longer to get any kind of decent yield now. So we've got to, you know, there are multiple factors at work there. One thing we've seen in the United States in addition to that is that corporate spreads, while corporate yields went up pretty dramatically post-Brexit as people were sort of sorting through the economics of global interest rates, they've reversed themselves and come back down. Once again, I think calmer heads are prevailing now, and we're back to the flight to yield on the bond side. Even lower quality bonds, sometimes you know, referred to as high yield or junk bonds, they've come back as well. I think, again, as people look and say, where can I find some yield? So the hunt for yield exists really just in the United States these days. In everywhere else around the world, Japan and the EU, there just aren't many alternatives. So we're forced here in the United States to look at other types of securities beyond traditional treasuries and agencies. We look at different types of corporate securities and other, again, non-government types of securities to produce really any kind of yield whatsoever.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. We're going to quickly try and run through stocks. There's obviously a lot that happened in June, so I apologize that we're going a little bit longer than normal. In terms of the market in June, the S&P 500 finished up positive 0.3%. So obviously, and there was a lot of volatility around Brexit, but, you know, pretty benign month. The Russell 2000, an indicator for small cap stocks, basically finished flat. And then international stocks struggled a little bit more, as you might expect, down 1.5%. And if you look specifically at Europe, the Europe 350 was down about 5% for the month. So a little bit more difficult outside of the U.S. borders. From a sector standpoint, defensive stocks continue to lead. Telecom and utilities and consumer staples were the three leading sectors, all up 5% or more. And I suspect that that's really a function of what happened in terms of interest rates. All three of those sectors have stocks that have higher dividend yields. There were four sectors that were slightly negative: materials, consumer discretionary, information technology, and financials. One other note about the two top sectors, I was really surprised to see this. Both telecom services and utility stocks up almost 25% year-to-date. So very unusual environment to see defensive stocks lead in the manner that they are. And again, I think there may be maybe a function of what's going on in the bond market that's impacting that particular part of the market. In terms of the Brexit impact, the vote was on Thursday, June 23rd. The following 2 days, the Friday and Monday, the S&P 500 was down about 5.5%. But then we saw the market rally the next 3 days. So if you just measure the market on the Thursday before Brexit to the end of the month, minus 0.7%. So again, not much of an impact here in the U.S. with our stock market. Some of that may have been short covering, but still very little impact to U.S. stocks. Year to date, the S&P 500 is now up 3.8%. Really, you know, it seems like February was so long ago, but if you remember, we had a difficult start to 2016, and amazingly, the S&P 500 is up almost 16% off the February low. To look at a little bit longer period, the market has basically moved sideways for 18 months, and I don't think it's a coincidence that it was 18 months ago the Fed, roughly 18 months ago, that the Fed discontinued the QE program. We had really strong 2013, pretty decent 2014, and since then, the average stock, if you look at the value line arithmetic index, which is 1,700 different stocks, it's down 0.5% for the 18 months. Can't get much more sideways than that. Just to compare, the capitalization-weighted S&P 500 is up 3.5% annualized for that same 18-month period. So where do we go from here? I'll start with some positives. And really, there's two factors that have played a major influence on the market as of late, and they're showing positive trends. The first is the price of oil. If you've listened to our calls on a regular basis, the movement between oil and the price of stocks earlier this year was unprecedented. It was almost a one-for-one movement in stocks. As oil went down, stocks went down. As oil went up, stocks went up. And fortunately, that was when the oil price was reaching historic lows in the mid-20s, or at least, you know, 15-year lows. And we've seen a significant bounce off that level to where oil seems to have stabilized in the high 40s. And I think, you know, one thing that's really positive is that as we went through this volatility, the price of oil really seemed to remain strong. And I think that's a positive for stocks. It's a good sign. And also the fact that the correlation between stocks and oil seems to be declining, I believe, is also another positive. I think there was concern that you could have a credit market crisis when oil prices were down in the 20s. That has since abated. We're not out of the woods yet, but it does seem to the oil rig count appears to have bottomed. So there's some positive signs there that we hope will continue that could be a positive for stocks going forward. Also, the strength of the dollar. The dollar actually, believe it or not, has weakened first quarter, second quarter, not substantially, but versus a basket of major world currencies, and that is actually a positive for earnings. A weaker dollar, especially companies, larger companies that have a lot of international business, a weaker dollar makes their goods and services more attractive to other countries. So, you know, if that trend continues, that will also be a positive. What we don't need to see is a significant strengthening of the dollar. That could be a negative for stocks on a going forward basis. Another positive, we talk a lot about central banks, and Jeff talked about the Fed. You know, it looks like they're on hold. But central banks across the globe continue to ease and pump liquidity into the system. Since the financial crisis, we've seen central banks be very aggressive. The money has to go somewhere. A lot of times money has ended up moving into stocks, and this has been a positive lift for stocks. So as a result of Brexit, central banks have made it clear and have already started programs to inject liquidity in the system. This could be a short-term, or repeat, short-term positive for stocks. We could do a whole call on some of the long-term negative implications of the central bank actions that have occurred for many years. But for now, at least for the short-term, we do view this as a potential positive for stocks. And then lastly, the third positive, and really this is sort of a contrary indicator, regards flows out of equity ETFs and mutual funds. There are many different organizations that monitor the amount of money moving in and out of equity ETFs and mutual funds. And before I give you where we are, to give you some perspective, if you remember the financial crisis and the significant market downturn that we had in 2008 and 2009, those 2 years combined, 2 years combined, $86 billion net flows left equity mutual funds and ETFs. In 2015, we set a new record, $72 billion net fund flows out of equity funds. And for the first 6 months of 2016, $74 billion. Have moved out of equity funds and ETFs. And it's really, again, it's sort of a contrary indicator because at some point that's going to turn. And when it does, that could potentially provide a lift to stocks. So that covers the potential positives. And, you know, unfortunately, there are also a lot of headwinds that the market are facing, many of which we've talked on this call for the last several months. And I mentioned earlier that the market has moved sideways for 18 months. This would normally be a good thing as it allows earnings to catch up to the market. However, and Richard Chauvin talked about this a little last month, earnings have also been flat. They've been flat really going back to 2014. And just to give you some numbers, if you look at earnings for the S&P 500, the second quarter of 2014, the S&P 500 produced $118 on an annualized basis earnings. If you move forward to 2015, the second quarter of 2015, that number was $117. Second quarter of 2016 just ended. That number is going to come in somewhere around $115. There is the potential. It looks like some of the economic data was a little bit more positive, but we could hit that 117, 118 number that we saw in 2014 or 2015. But basically, no earnings growth when you look quarter over quarter, looking at, you know, prior second quarters over the last 2 years. So as a result, you know, we've talked about this price for perfection environment. It still exists. The S&P forward PE now at 16.5 is near the top of its two-year range. And, you know, not to dismiss, we do think there are still opportunities to make money in stocks. We still believe expected returns for stocks are in the mid-single digits. And, you know, that's we're constantly bringing that out to clients because I think a lot of times people have that 10% number that we saw historically for so many years as what they think is an expected number for stocks. The reality is, given where we are, that a mid-single-digit return is probably a more expected return, And when you look at where interest rates are today, that's not such a bad return. And hopefully through active management, managers can provide better returns beyond what one would expect from the S&P 500 on a going forward basis. Really, you know, to get a big move, a substantially higher move in stocks, we'll need to see a much higher or much improved earnings environment on a going forward basis. John, you have anything you would like to add to that?
No, that pretty well covers it. You hate to think of the future as being one that's relatively blah, I guess. Is that the right word to use? But that's sort of the way it looks at the present time. It's just not as exciting as we would like it, but not necessarily disastrous either.
All right. Thank you, John. Thank you, Jeff. And thank you, everyone, for joining today. Join us next month when our market and economic update call will be on August 2nd. Thank you.